All right, if you would open up your Bibles to the book of Ruth. We began this study last week. This will be the second sermon in the first chapter. Lord willing, we'll finish this chapter today. But I had to caution myself as I was studying through this and reading through this. It's so easy, especially in a short book. It's only four chapters. It's easy to view this book in hindsight. You know, it's easy to read the actions and reactions of Orpah and Ruth and Naomi through the optics of chapter 4. But we need to put that aside. We need to actually try to get in their shoes and actually, or get in their sandals, so to speak, and see what they're really dealing with. You know, we can't look at this knowing the outcome of chapter 4. That doesn't make some of the events happen here as spectacular as they actually are. Jacob began this study last week. He covered the first five verses. And in those first five verses, just to give you a little bit of background, it says in the very first verse, in the days when judges ruled. So that is when this book takes place. It takes place in the time when judges ruled, in the days of the judges. And we're told in Judges chapter 2, verse 11, here's the atmosphere. Here's the environment in the days when judges ruled. Chapter 2, verse 11. And the people of Israel did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and they served the Baals. They abandoned the Lord, the God of their fathers, whom had brought them out of the land of Egypt. They went after other gods from among the gods of the people who were around them. They bowed down to them, and they provoked the Lord to anger. That's the background. That's the backdrop in the book of Ruth. And we're told there was a famine in the land. A famine in Bethlehem. Ironically, Bethlehem means house of bread. So in Judah, which was the promised land, the land flowing with milk and honey, in Bethlehem, the house of bread, in the land flowing with milk and honey, their resources are depleted. And it's clear that this famine comes from the Lord. This famine is from the hand of God. And we're told why. Deuteronomy 32 gives us a warning of these things. And the Lord is clear. When you forsake Him, He will bring these judgments upon you. And He gives this list. It begins with plagues and pestilence and hunger was one of them. And so with the people of Judah serving other gods, which seems to be a trademark for this generation, a move to Moab really doesn't seem unthinkable. So Elimelech moves his family to Moab. Now, again, it's easy to judge, but we've never faced starvation. We say things like, I'm starving. No, you're not. You know, most of us have no idea what it's like to truly be without. And then to have your children depending on you. And then Elimelech even had the examples of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. During the famine, Abraham, the father of their faith, fled Egypt. Isaac relocates during the famine. Jacob and his family relocate during the famine. So you can see how he came to this conclusion. I'm not saying it's right. I'm just saying you can see how he gets there. So why would Elimelech go to Moab? Again, the last verse, Jacob, I know, read this one last week. It said in the last verse in the book of Judges, one page to your left. In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. Elimelech was just doing what was right in his own eyes. But what we have in this book is just another example of God using the mistakes of men to further His purpose. You know, we just got through reading the same thing in Genesis with Joseph. His brothers had sold him into slavery. But that was the plan and purpose of God. God using the mistakes of men to further His purpose. That's how big our God is. We're also told in that last verse there was no kings. There was no king in Israel. And there, in those days, in the days when judges ruled, there was no king in Israel. But yet in verse 2, we're introduced to a man named Elimelech, whose name means God is king. So in the middle of this era, the era of the judges, we're told there's no king. And then the book of Ruth reminds the reader, God is king. And his family, again, they move to Moab. Elimelech dies, I think in verse 3. He falls off the pages of Scripture. His wife, Naomi, will become the central figure, or one of the central figures in this story. And what we have in verses 1 through 5 is what is referred to as the emptying of Naomi. Because as Naomi was in Bethlehem, she was full. That's her description in verse 21. I went out full. She went out full. She was in Bethlehem with a husband and two sons. You know, in Genesis we read of Sarah, who longed for a son most of her adult life. 90 years old before she gave birth to Isaac. Rebecca, likewise, was barren for some time. Rachel was unable to bear children for many years. We even have Hannah, who's unable to bear children, and she's actually laughed at and mocked. And Scripture said it caused her to be deeply distressed. So to have two sons, of course Naomi felt full. And now, all of this has been stripped away. Naomi's been emptied, as Scripture tells us. But in some of the darkest days in Israel, in the darkest days of Naomi's life, a good report will come. In verse 6, a good report will come from the land of Judah. And news of this report will compel Naomi to return to the land of Judah. This is what we're going to read today. And it's during this return, there's a pivotal moment in the life of Orpah and in the life of Ruth. And we get the picture, at least I do. I get the mental picture of them really just standing at the crossroads. Standing by a signpost, really. And one way points to earthly security. And one way points to eternal security. One way offers your people, your family, your security, all the blessings of this life. And it comes with your gods. The other way comes without. It's a life without. It's an absence of all the comforts of life, only to be counted with the people of God. And as I thought about those crossroads, it made me question, how tight do you hang on to earthly treasures? You know, we read of the rich man. You know, the rich man who went away sorrowful because he had many possessions. He chose his possessions over Christ. He refused to follow the Lord because of his riches, because of his possessions, his security. But do you truly grab on to the fact that this earth is passing away? Your life is but a vapor. You can't hold on to these treasures on earth. They will slip through your grasp. Are you willing to trade the slippery for the secure? There was a missionary by the name of Jim Elliot. He died on the mission field. And he's quoted as saying this, quote, "He is no fool who gives up what he cannot gain." I'm sorry, I messed that up. "He is no fool who gives up what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose." Unquote. There's a lot of wisdom in that. He would never be able to hang on to these earthly possessions, so he was willing to let them go. He couldn't keep them anyway. And he laid up treasures in heaven, which he could never lose. There's a lot of wisdom in that. But as I thought about it, that's what Orpah are faced with standing at this crossroads here today. We see them. Which path would you choose? We'll see, they go in completely opposite directions. So that's the title of this message, standing at the crossroads. With that in mind, let's finish reading this chapter. Verse 6. Then she, referring to Naomi, then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab. For she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. So she set out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. But Naomi said to her two daughter-in-laws, "Go, return each of you to your mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." Then she kissed them. They lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, go your way, for I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they are grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." Then they lifted up their voices and wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. And she said, "See, your daughter-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God, my God. Where I die, where you die, I will die. And there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. So the two of them went on their way until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" She said to them, "Do not call me Naomi. Call me Mara. For the Almighty has dealt bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" So Naomi returned, and Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her, who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. So, again, we see early on that Naomi had gone from full to empty. That's her language in verse 21. Went away full, the Lord brought me back empty. You contrast that against Jacob, which we just read. Jacob went out empty when he went into his uncle Laban. He went out empty and he came back full. He came back with four wives and 12 sons. Complete opposite here. She leaves with a husband, two sons, come back empty. Again, it's easy for us to look at Naomi as throwing some type of pity party. But really, just think of it. She's lost her husband. She's lost both her sons. And this was in a society where men provided, where men protected. Now she's going to be forced to rely on the generosity and charity of others. You know, the welfare system in place at this time, in this day, consisted of the poor gleaning from the fields. And Naomi was old. Naomi's been emptied, verses 1 through 5. And in that setting, it's just a dark picture. You just get a dark picture introducing this book. But in this dark time, the light returns. The Lord had visited His people and given them food. A transition. First chapter, verse 6. The story begins to have a positive outlook. It had been nothing but a downward trajectory. Now the Lord had visited His people. Now things are starting to trend in an upward momentum, positive outlook here. The Lord, Yahweh, had visited His people. This is the first time Yahweh is mentioned in this book. And this Yahweh visited his people and given them food. Hebrew, he had given them bread. Daniel Block wrote, quote, Bethlehem, the house of bread, was being restocked. Close quote. So Yahweh visits his people. Let's take a minute and just get into this word visited, because it's pretty interesting what it's talking about here. I'll examine a few other places where this word is used, and I believe it'll kind of help us understand what it means when it says Yahweh, the Lord, visited his people. One of those places is in Genesis 21. Genesis 21, the first verse says this, the Lord visited Sarah as he had said, and the Lord did to Sarah as he had promised. Well, what had he promised? What did he said? Go back to chapter 18 of Genesis. It says this. The Lord said in the hearing of Sarah, I will surely return to you about this time next year, and Sarah, your wife, shall have a son. So when the Lord visits Sarah, he's fulfilling a promise he made to her. He promised he would return to her at this same time next year, and you shall have a son. Chapter 21 said he visited her and he did to her as he had promised. Exodus chapter 4 verse 31 says this. The people believed when they heard the Lord had visited his people, the people of Israel. He had seen their affliction. They bowed their heads and they worshiped the Lord. So what did the Lord see? When he had seen their affliction, what he saw, they were being harshly treated by Pharaoh. Exodus 4, we know the story. They had harshly been treated by Pharaoh, and the Lord heard their cry, and he visits them. Well, what promise was he fulfilling there? He had told them in chapter 15 of Genesis, you will be slaves in a foreign land for 400 years, and after that, I will come and I will bring you up. So in chapter 4 of Exodus, he is visiting them. He is fulfilling a promise he made to them every time, or most of the time when this word is used, it's referring to that covenant promise of God. So what does that have to do with Ruth? Again, this word is directly tied to Yahweh, the Lord's faithfulness to his promise, to his people. He had not forsaken his people. That's the point. He had punished them, but he had not abandoned them. They may have forsaken him, but in his mercy and in his faithfulness, he visits them and he gives them bread. And the word of this faithfulness of Yahweh reaches the pagan land of Moab. Because it says clearly, Naomi was in the fields of Moab when she heard this. For she heard in the fields of Moab, that the Lord. She's actually still in Moab, and the news comes to this pagan society that Yahweh has visited his people and given them bread. And upon hearing this, verse 6, she arose to return. She arose to return for she heard, because she heard. She returned because the Lord had visited his people and given them bread. Without doubt, that's the reason for her return to Judah, without question. And then verses 8 through 18, we're going to get this lengthy dialogue between these three women, Orpah, Ruth, Naomi. But at the end of verse 7, it says they set out for the purpose of returning to Judah. That's why they set out. They set out to go to Judah because the Lord had visited his people. And it's interesting that they use the word return. In reality, only one of them is returning. And that's Naomi. And during this trip home, somewhere along the way, Naomi's going to stop. And we're going to see this here in just a moment. She's going to stop and she's going to have a heart-to-heart with her daughters. Or her daughters-in-law. And for the next 10 verses, we have this dialogue, this back and forth between Naomi and her daughters-in-law. And at the end, I believe we actually see Ruth's faith is actually stronger than Naomi's. But there's one aspect of Naomi's faith that she is 100% right on. She's right on this. The Lord is in control. She refers to this often. She refers to this in verses 20 and 21. She refers to the Lord two times there as the Almighty. The Almighty, the All-Powerful One. The famine, the death of her husband, the death of her sons, all that she referred to as calamity. All this happened by the will of God. She knew that. The Lord sent me out. The Lord brought me back. The Lord brought all this upon me. She understood that God was over all this. She understood that God had not lost His grip on this world. He was not caught off guard. That thought never even entered her mind. And it should never enter yours. The Almighty is sovereign over the affairs of men. But Naomi had been beaten down by this world. The hand she had been dealt was tough. Her story actually resembles Job, if you were to read the book of Job. And this emptying of Naomi, again, by the hand of God, drives her to a state of despair, a state of hopelessness. Naomi's not a glass half empty type of person. She's a glass completely empty type of person. Let's read 8 through 10. But Naomi said to her daughter, to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each in your house of your husband." Then she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, we will return with you to your people." So you see, in her hopelessness, she actually looks at her daughter-in-law and she urges them to remain in Moab. In her first argument, this first argument we read right here, she's telling them all the positives of staying in Moab. Return to your mother's house. You know, you have your family, your people, a future husband, hopefully your own family. Don't trade the known for the unknown. But it's also interesting, too, before I move on, that she refers in verse 9, Naomi is going to refer to marriage as rest. May each of you find rest, each in the house of your husband. She refers to children as blessings and marriage as rest. So leave it to a godless society like ours to take the blessings of children and consider them a hindrance. To take the blessing of marriage, which is considered rest, and we consider it turmoil at times. You know, Naomi had a good view of marriage and a good view of motherhood. It was just all been stripped from her. And she's wanting the hope that she had lost, she's wanting to give it to her daughters-in-law. And then she's offering here these blessings. I almost hesitate to use the word empty or hypocritical. They're kind of, verse 8 and 9, "May the Lord deal kindly with you," she says in verse 8. Verse 9, "May the Lord grant you rest." But at the same time, Naomi is saying, "The hand of the Lord has gone out against me. The Lord has dealt very bitterly with me," verse 20. "The Lord has emptied me. The Lord has testified against me. The Almighty has brought calamity upon me. But maybe He'll be good to you." It just seems odd. What is her actions and her attitude don't reflect what she's confessing. This is a great example of where our walk doesn't mirror our talk. The way we live our lives are so disconnected from what we say. You know, Naomi's bitter. And she's laying all this at the feet of God. He's gone out against me. He's emptied me. But yet she's trying to tell them He'll bless you. You see the disconnect there in how she's walking versus how she's talking? It's almost a Jekyll and Hyde. It's the tale of two Naomis. If Naomi was a modern-day Christian missionary, she'd be doing a very good job of talking people out of following Christ. But nonetheless, both of these women, Orpah and Ruth, weep and mourn and pledge to return with Naomi. Verses 11 through 13, Naomi's going to bring another argument. Verse 11, but Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters. Go your way, for I'm too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they are grown? Why would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." She brings another argument. This argument, there's no positives. The first one was all positive. You have your people, your family, a husband, a house, all this. Now it's only the negatives of following me. Only the negative. It's going to be a tough life. That's what she's trying to stress. This is going to be a tough life. And her words this time are way more forceful. You see, turn back. You know, it's that turn back. Twice. Verse 12, turn back. Verse 13, no, my daughter-in-law. You see, the people of Israel in this day were to help care for the widow. That's what they were to do. And when we had that same charge laid on us. But with this nation of Israel being in a godless state, there was no guarantee that that would happen. Plus, these two women were Moabite women. The Moabites were hated by the people of Israel. If you remember back, it's just been a few hundred years ago, that as these Moabite women seduced the men of Israel into sexual immorality, and then to worshiping their gods. And it causes the Lord to bring death upon them. So you see, they were hated. Moabites were hated. So more than likely, when Ruth and Orpah returned with Naomi to Bethlehem, no man would have her. No man would have her. There's no promise of that in Judah for you, Ruth and Orpah. Besides, I'm too old to have a husband. And if I did have a husband, would you restrain from marrying until they were grown and then take them? No. No. But what Naomi has done is she has placed her faith in the back seat. She's only given them practical, pragmatic advice. This is terrible spiritual advice. We see Orpah returns, but Ruth will cling to her. And then Naomi's actually going to use the actions of Orpah trying to attempt Naomi to stay one more time. Verse 15. And she said, this is Naomi, "See, look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." Notice, look. At first reading, like I said, you see Naomi is just trying to be a good mother-in-law. Wanting them to have a family. Wanting them to have a good life now. But a faithful Naomi should have been telling Ruth and Orpah to forsake their gods. Serve only the God of Israel. Serve only Yahweh. Even if that means a harder life in Judah. But that's not the advice she was given. So you take a step back. Do you give worldly advice? Or do you give godly advice? They're not always the same. We should give godly advice. We should give godly counsel, even at the risk of sounding like a fool. Because it would have been foolish if someone would have overheard Naomi telling Orpah, You need to leave your family. You need to leave your gods, and you need to come with me. And we'll be destitute widows together. That sounds foolish to the world. But that's exactly what Naomi should have been telling them. And then Ruth, her response to this in the next two verses are just staggering. She says, and I think this is pretty forceful in verse 16. But Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I'll lodge. Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me and more also if anything but death parts me from you. Do not urge me to leave you." Or the NET translation, "Stop urging me to abandon you." And then she utters these six promises. Unconditional. These are unconditional. These are unilateral, as we may say. There's not, "If you do this, Naomi, then I will do this." Unconditional. You go where you go, I'll go. Where you lodge, I'll lodge. Your people will be my people. Your God, my God. Where you die, I'll die. And there I will be buried. Not if Naomi did anything. This is what I'm doing. All this calamity has come upon you, Naomi. May the Lord do so to me and more if anything but death parts us. Everything you talked about, Naomi, let the Lord bring that upon me if anything but death parts me from you. And if you notice in this list, Ruth only refers to death and burial. Where you die, I'll die. Where you're buried, there I'll be buried. You see, Ruth doesn't look forward to life and prosperity. And see, that makes sense because Naomi had been informing them the whole time that the life that lay ahead of them was a life of desolate widowhood. Nothing good can come out of following me. So why would Ruth think anything would come out of this? So it's clear to me that Ruth's decision to return was not motivated by a better life in Judah. Rather, the opposite. Naomi had painted a bleak picture. Understandably, it'd be just them. No children, no security. But all this really doesn't even move the needle for Ruth. She was committed to Naomi. She was committed to Yahweh. She was committed to the people of Israel. This is amazing. For Ruth to follow God here defies logic. "Your God will be my God," is what she says. Naomi's God. The God who had emptied Naomi. The one who had dealt bitterly with Naomi. The one who had brought calamity upon Naomi. The one who was against Naomi. "That God will be my God." This defies logic. Again, I was talking to Todd about this. I got to give him credit for it. He don't say many wise things. But here we go. Todd told me this. He said, "Brian, just think about the thief on the cross." So just think about that. You know, as a thief is just hanging on that cross, hours away from death, he looks to his left and there Jesus is. Beaten, bloody, scourged, unrecognizable. Cursed, spit upon, mocked. And you look at his feet and it's just a handful of people there that followed him to his death. And the thief looks at him and says, "You are my God." Does that resonate? I mean, what am I? It's just amazing. You know, do you see the faith of the thief on the cross? To say that, "You are my God." Do you see the faith of Ruth? No doubt. Ruth was a wise, godly woman. Maybe, if nothing else, she had enough knowledge to know that Chemosh, the god of the Moabites, was no god. Yet, your God, Naomi, is powerful. Your God, Naomi, is faithful to His promises. He's visited His people. He returned to His people, even though His people have forsaken and forsook and rejected Him. He still returns to them. He's faithful to His word. Your God will be my God. Ruth is so immovable, so firm, so determined, it says here, that Naomi quit trying to dissuade her, is what the NET translation say. That lets us know this was not a test. Naomi was not testing the faith of Ruth before she brought her back to Bethlehem. She was legitimately trying to get her to stay in Moab. Not testing. This wasn't a test before I allow you to tag along. And then you see 19 through 22, they're going to arrive. So the two of them, Ruth, Naomi, went on until they came to Bethlehem. And when they came to Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the women said, "Is this Naomi?" She said, "Do not call me Naomi, call me Mara, for the Almighty has dealt very bitterly with me. I went away full, and the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi, when the Lord has testified against me and the Almighty has brought calamity upon me?" You ever considered how awkward it had to have been for Naomi to re-enter Bethlehem? You know, she abandoned Bethlehem. She abandoned the house of bread. She abandoned the people of God during a famine. Left with a husband and two sons. Returns. Her words, empty. No husband, no sons. Only a Moabite daughter-in-law. And you see, the people are stirred. "Is that you, Naomi?" They're not questioning her identity. It's more of a, "Hey, is that you, Brian? You been working out?" I get that a lot. That's sad that y'all are laughing at that. "But is that you, Naomi?" They recognize her. He said, "Do no longer call me Naomi. Call me Mara." See, Naomi was bitter. And that's what Mara means. Mara means bitter. She even tried to change her name to reflect this attitude. And just for the record, no one ever refers to her as Mara. This word won't pop back up in this book. "Call me Mara." So bitter. "Nothing good has happened to me, only bad. I returned empty, went out full, come back empty. Nothing good to show for my 10-year stay in Moab." And yet Ruth stands beside her as a reminder or a symbol of Naomi's bitter experience. You can only imagine her shoulders drooped, her head hangs low as she hears her mother-in-law saying, "Nothing good has happened to me in the last 10 years. And as John Piper says, she says that when the best thing that's ever happened to Naomi was standing right beside her. And this good-for-nothing Moabite, here's what the women of the town say about Ruth in chapter 4. The women of the town say this: "For your daughter-in-law," referring to Ruth, "who loves you, is more to you than seven sons. But you came back empty." I think we often misread our circumstances. The Lord wasn't against Naomi. The Lord was doing great things through this event. How often do we look at our circumstances in life? We misread them. We look at them through these Mara glasses. "Oh, nothing's good happened. It's all bad. Lord's against me. Good things only happen to other people." Verse 22. So Naomi returned. And Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, with her. who returned from the country of Moab, and they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest, late April, early May. Barley was the first crop harvested each year. It's just a reminder, plugged away right here, just a reminder that the Lord had visited His people. We transitioned from famine to harvest. It just so happens they came at the beginning of barley harvest, right? Look, as you read this book, again, not looking at it through hindsight, but just reading this book, it's almost, you know, like you get another bite of the apple. Every time you read it, it's layered. You know, the first pass through chapter 1, you see the people forsaking God. And yet God faithfully delivers them. God faithfully provides for them. He doesn't forsake His covenant with them. You read that and you say, man, God is good. Then when we read on, a second bite into this, and I don't mean to get into chapter 2, but just look in chapter 2, verse 3. Just the last half of chapter, last half of verse 3. Talking about Ruth, it says, and she happened to come to the part of the field belonging to Boaz. It just so happened that that's where Ruth ended up, right? But you see, even the Lord is working out some of the smallest details in all this. He's bringing about this meeting between Boaz and Ruth that will provide a life of rest for Ruth. And you say, God is really good. And then when you step back and read one more time, and we're informed later in this book that God is using this event. God is using this Moabite woman, Ruth. Ruth will bear a son who will fulfill all the promises made to Abraham. God is still working out the promises He made to Abraham, bringing forth the seed, bringing forth the Savior in the darkest days of Israel. And you say, God is really, really good. You know, you just keep getting more and more every time you read this. But again, we know the outcome. So looking at it from a chapter 4 perspective, it's easy to see. I would have went the way of Ruth. Orpah's a fool for going the other way. And she is. Ruth is rewarded for having the faith that she has in the God of Naomi, Yahweh. Orpah will die in a lost state with her gods. But at that moment, when you are standing at the crossroads, earthly securities versus eternal securities, which do you choose? Do you cling to these things so tightly that you end up walking away sorrowful like the rich man? Or do you forsake all to follow Christ? You forsake all so that Yahweh, the God of Israel, will be your God. Think about that. When you're standing at the crossroads, would please stand.